is number 062897, Jonathan Siegel against Cation, New York City, NYC. We'll let the courtroom clear for a minute before we start. Mr. Mayor, I think we can start now.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jeff Mayer on behalf of Jonathan Siegel. May it please the court if I proceed, as well as for opposing counsel. Jonathan Siegel is one of the founders of the successful Chicago Japanese restaurant, one of five, in fact. And he's brought his lawsuit because three of the founders proceeded to open a New York restaurant using the Japanese marks. The three founders did so in secret and without his knowledge. The crux of his complaint, as presented in court below, was that he had a right to determine on his own whether he could proceed to be an investor founder in the New York venture and other restaurants outside of Chicago. But one of the counts he brought, and that's the count we're here on today, is the Lanham Act count, because count nine said that not only were the New York Japanese restaurants improperly excluding Mr. Siegel from participation, but those restaurants were also using the Japanese marks without permission. And on our complaint, there's no question that on the record, there is no consent for the New York entities to use the mark. Not only are they strangers to the mark, but they're also owned in part by strangers to the Chicago entities. The district court nonetheless dismissed the count on the grounds that because one of the operating agreements for the Chicago entities, the Hospitality LLC, contains an expansion provision, it must follow as a matter of course that because expansion is expressly contemplated, use by these entities of the marks is expressly authorized. And that's not a logical conclusion for several reasons. First, the Hospitality LLC operating agreement, the agreement that contains the expansion provision, is an agreement between and among the individual founders. It does not establish a relationship between the corporate entities, one in Chicago, Geisha Chicago, and the one in New York, Geisha New York, that are using and owning the marks in theory. As such, that cannot bind those two companies. Second, if we look at that intermediate step that's missing, both Geisha Chicago and Geisha New York have operating agreements. The Hospitality Chicago has section 6.1.1, which is in fact cited by the defendants, which says the managing member can act. The Geisha Chicago agreement has in section 6.1 a provision for corporate action. And the suggestion by the district court is that that is in fact an intermediate step that's technical and unnecessary. But that can't be the case under this operating agreement. For example, even if you were to accept the defendant's position that they're entitled to use the marks without charge, there would still remain all types of duties and responsibilities with regard to the mark. In our complaint, we allege, for example, that $1 million was invested in developing the brand. There might be additional monies invested in developing the brand. How should that be allocated? Additionally, what if two of the founders, because as defendants read the provision, only two out of the five can open a restaurant, and they can do it against the wishes of the other three, what if their food was subpar, subquality, or their actions tarnished the mark? In those cases, it would be simply a normal exercise of corporate responsibility to have an appropriate license agreement. So in this case, it's not an intermediate step. Now, Your Honors do not have to decide what the term should be. The issue on appeal is simply whether or not that consent is necessary, whether the absence of that consent dooms our complaint. And, of course, it does not. The refusal to provide that information is purely strategic. If there was, in fact, a corporate resolution, something that defendants say would be easy to do and within their power, and it said, for example, we hereby license the Japanese trademarks for 1 cent to the folks in New York, then that would be under attack. Either, for example, as inadequate consent under Count 9 of the Lanham Act, or perhaps it would be adequate corporate consent, but then it would expose the defendants to claims of breach of fiduciary duty, claims that are not waived under this document. Instead, the defendants have simply said to Mr. Siegel, you have no right to know what we're doing, we do not have to take any corporate action, and the mere fact that we're allowed to expand in our view is enough to exempt us from something that we agree that we could have done. At this stage of the case, in a motion to dismiss, that's simply inadequate. Furthermore, there's a logical fallacy in the district court's reasoning, and I can point it out with one example. Merely because expansion is contemplated does not mean that this expansion is within the contemplation. Now, everyone agrees that under 6.2.1 of the operating agreement, Mr. Siegel, as a founder, has at a minimum a right to have as good an offer as non-founders participating. So, for example, in the New York venture, even if he's not an expanding founder, he should have at least the opportunity of a non-expanding founder, such as defendant Nordic Management. As alleged, he does not have such a right. He was not made the offer of Nordic Management. What was the defendant's response? Their response was, well, 6.2.1 only applies to the quote-unquote restaurant. And New York is divided into Geisha New York, which is the restaurant entity, and Hospitality, which is the management entity. So they've taken the position that the reason that they didn't give Mr. Siegel any rights in the management arm was because the management arm in New York is outside the scope of 6.2.1. But that runs straight into their primary argument. Because if Hospitality, which is benefiting from the marks and is making money off the marks and is owned by strangers to the marks, is outside 6.2.1, whatever consent might be embedded in 6.2.1 cannot extend to the hospitality arm, which defendants themselves say has is not within the scope of 6.2.1. One final point before I cede for a rebuttal. In our view, it's not important for the court to parse through 6.2.1. The parties could agree that Mr. Siegel was excluded from expansion or not excluded from expansion. And that's an issue that's being decided by the Circuit Court of Cook County right now. But if you accept their position that the five founders sat down and said, we agree that any two of us can go and open a restaurant using our marks, it doesn't make any sense that the three who said the two could move out would not ask for the right to issue some type of corporate resolution or license and maintain control over their property. So defendants' argument defeats itself. To the extent they are correct, and we vehemently deny they're correct and have briefed that issue at length in Cook County, that Mr. Siegel or the other founders, as the case may be involuntarily excluded from national expansion, all it means is the intent of the founders at the time they signed the agreement could not be that the mark could be given out across the country without any controls whatsoever. Therefore, it's improper to imply consent from the expansion provision as a matter of law, and the district court's decision on count 9 should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We'll hear now from Mr. Berger.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This appeal is ultimately about authorization, and plaintiff's Lanham Act claim fails as a matter of law because the New York entities, the defendants here, their use of the trademark was permitted. There was no risk of confusion about the affiliation of Japanet New York with Japanet Chicago because the corporate structure of Japanet Chicago permitted the use of its trademark in an expansion. Three of the founders, there's actually four founders, three of them invoked the relevant provision and created the Japanet New York entities. Because this expansion was authorized, plaintiff had no viable Section 43 claim. And I do want to turn to the language.
Is it clear that even if it was authorized to, without compensation or without any control by the Illinois Corporation?
And to answer that question, Your Honor, I do actually want to turn to the language of the agreement because I think it is critical here. It's located on pages 79 through 81 of the appendix. The perfect language, the right-on language, is at page 80. There's two parts. There's 6.2.1, which states that if at least two of the founders seek to open a restaurant, I'm slightly paraphrasing, outside of Chicago, the expanding founders need to deliver written notice, and they need to explain that written notice what the terms and conditions are of both founding and expanding founders and non-expanding founders. Now, the critical language is in 6.2.2, because what that does is that defines the term concept. And concept was not left to chance here. Concept specifically says that if an expansion is to occur, that expanded restaurant must be substantially similar to the Japanese Chicago restaurant, including use of the trademarks. By defining concept within that definition, that authorization for the expansion, it makes the authorization of the trademark inseparable from the authorization from the expansion. And there's no other contractual provisions, and this is getting back to Your Honor's question. There's no other contractual provisions, many of which are what plaintiff essentially seeks to impose here. There's no license requirement. There's no royalty requirement. And that's not necessarily unusual, and it shouldn't be seen as unusual. For example, plaintiff explains in his brief that there was no royalty payment. And that's a big issue, is that Geisha Chicago is not receiving any funds from Japanese New York on account of the trademark. But it must be kept in mind what the purpose of this entire endeavor was. As plaintiff both alleges and admits in his complaint, the very purpose of Japanese Chicago was with an eye towards national expansion. That national expansion, that expansion, that growth of the brand couldn't occur without the intellectual property. And the notion in this tightly interrelated grouping of restaurants, the notion that the intellectual property would be used by one without necessarily paying for a license or paying royalties for a license from the other, shouldn't necessarily be at all surprising.
Was that eye to a national expansion, is that memorialized someplace in the contract?
It is actually does not appear in the contract. But
we can't go into that, can we? At this point in the litigation.
I take plaintiff alleges it in his complaint, so we must accept it as true, and that's basically what we're doing. It's paragraph 20, which is on page 14 of the appendix. That's the critical language. It's actually alleged. It does appear other places in the complaint that when these founders got together, they were thinking, like many good restaurateurs, they were thinking ahead not just of Japanese Chicago, but of other restaurants as well. And it makes sense within that context to think of the intellectual property. You couldn't expand the brand. You couldn't do that without use of the intellectual property. Because of this authorization, no one is going to walk into Japanese New York and be confused about its affiliation with Japanese Chicago. And this is getting back to the elements of a Lanham Act claim. No one is going to walk into Japanese New York and be confused about its activities being condoned by Japanese Chicago. And the reason is that Japanese New York is affiliated with Japanese Chicago, and the use of the trademark is permitted by Japanese Chicago. What plaintiff's Lanham Act claim ultimately revolves around, and this is, again, getting back to Your Honor's question, is trying to read certain language into this contract, into this Section 6.2 of the Hospitality Chicago Agreement. And what that does is essentially raise a more or less run-of-the-mill contract claim. It essentially makes his Lanham Act claim turn upon contractual language. And as an aside, plaintiff's contractual issues, many of his breach of contract claims, are currently being litigated in Illinois State Court. Most of what plaintiff's counsel was just arguing about really had to do with issues that are currently before Illinois State Court. And just the procedural progression of this is right after Judge Gottschalk dismissed the complaint. Before the notice of appeal was filed, plaintiff refiled almost all of his claims except the Lanham Act claim in Illinois State Court. And all these breach of contract issues, many of which plaintiff's counsel was discussing here today, are currently being litigated there. The court's decision in International Armor is interesting in this regard because there are similarities and it provides some insight. In International Armor, trade name issues were essentially construed by the court to be pure contract issues, regardless of the assertion of a Lanham Act claim. What plaintiff is essentially doing is a similar trick here. He's asking the court to interpret Section 6.2 so as to impose three additional requirements that none of the founders agreed to. Let's remember that plaintiff was a founder. The defendants, the individual defendants who founded Japanese New York, were also founders. They all agreed to these contracts together. They all agreed to them. They signed them with consent of counsel, with advice of counsel. And these provisions that plaintiff is trying to read in, which is improper, as your honors know, to change the language of a contract after its signing. For example, Section 6.2 doesn't limit the individual defendants, the founders, from expanding the concept as that's defined in Section 6.2.2 through other corporate entities that they control. As plaintiff alleges in his complaint, and this is paragraph 52, the New York entities were created solely to complete the expansion that's authorized by the contract. And there's no requirement that those expanding founders proceed with the expansion individually rather than through a corporate structure that they control. And I might just add that the New York entities, the corporate structure, is more or less identical to the Chicago structure in the sense that you have an entity, Geisha Chicago or Geisha New York, that owns pretty much everything about the restaurant. Plaintiff, in his brief, suggests, in his reply, suggests that it's just the intellectual property they own. That's not correct. They own everything. They own the napkins. They own the cash registers, everything a restaurant owns. The hospitality, Chicago or New York, controls the restaurant entity itself completely. It exercises all corporate control. Now, plaintiff exaggerates. He suggests that the New York entities are strangers to this litigation, strangers to Japanese Chicago. That is not entirely accurate. It's not even close. This isn't a situation where unrelated individuals just happen to start a restaurant in New York called Japanese with the same decor and the same mark. Rather, those with control over Japanese Chicago have complete control over Japanese New York. There's other contractual provisions that we've discussed on or touched upon that plaintiff is trying to impose. One, again, is a royalty or fee requirement. And just to reiterate, this isn't a free giveaway, as plaintiff suggests. This makes entire sense within the shape of the endeavor that all the founders planned, eventual national expansion of a restaurant they started in Chicago. In his brief, plaintiff also mentions, it wasn't mentioned in oral argument, mentions the lack of a licensing agreement or a separate license, separate negotiation. Again, there's no requirement in the contract, which all the parties agreed, that would be necessary. It's not simply enough, as plaintiff has suggested, to just list the elements of a Lanham Act claim and move on. That's not enough because plaintiff's claim fails as a matter of law because the operating agreements to which he attached to his complaint essentially undercut his false designation allegations. And these allegations don't exist in a vacuum, and the agreement shows that they are incorrect because the use of the trademark was authorized. As a result, the district court's decision should be affirmed because the New York entities were permitted to use that trademark. We have also asserted some alternate grounds for affirming the lower court. We'll just rest on our briefs, and unless your honors have any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Mayer have? Thank you.
Your Honor, to begin with, counsel confuses our position in the case with the issue on appeal. We have not asked this court to decide whether or not we should receive a royalty or whether or not there should be licensing standards. That's our position as to what would be necessary. The issue on appeal is whether or not the provision in an operating agreement between individuals is the functional and legal equivalent to a corporate resolution as a matter of law at this stage. And we say it's not. We also say what our position is in the case as to what would be sufficient. But we're not the ones who are looking to 6.2.1 to find a royalty provision. We believe that would arise out of the fiduciary duties. Our point simply is that it could not have been the party's intent as a matter of law to eliminate any possible corporate action for consent. Moreover, the crux of counsel's argument is that the two entities in New York are, quote-unquote, affiliated with the entities in Chicago. But there is no such evidence on this record. There's no legal citation that says merely because there's overlapping ownership between two sophisticated entities, they are, quote-unquote, affiliated. And there were multiple briefs to find such a site. And in fact, as we pointed out, the hospitality arm, which is where the money is, which is what's alleged in our complaint, is not affiliated. In fact, it's rather aggressively stated to be outside the scope of the expansion. Finally, the idea that this is a contract claim is ironic, since there is no contract between Geisha Chicago and Geisha New York. That's the crux of our complaint. To say it should be dismissed because it is masquerading as a contract claim is the height of irony. Without a contract, without a consent, without a corporate resolution, it was error for the court to dismiss our case merely because there was a potential for consent in the future, and merely because we have a view as to what that consent should look like, something which cannot be litigated now, is not reason to dismiss the Lanham Act count. Unless Your Honors have any questions, I'm complete.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.